a warm welcome back to all our fantastic listeners out there. I hope you're having a good day wherever you are. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Henrik, and this is Independent Radio. We do interviews and investigations into all the topics that we find interesting and important. You can follow us at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Bill Still is a former newspaper editor and publisher. He has written for USA Today, the Saturday Evening Post, the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and Omni Magazine. He has written 22 books and made 3 documentaries. These include The Money Masters, The Secret of Oz, and most recently Jekyll Island, The Truth Behind the Federal Reserve. Today our focus is how debt is ruining Greece and what they can do to get back on their feet again. We are also going to talk about the future of the European Union and the broken banking system of the world. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio. Bill Still, good to talk to you again. It was a while ago since you were on, and it was really interesting then, and it's good to have you back. So thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you for coming on. The last time I was on, I got feedback from hearing the interview on the show for months afterwards.
Excellent. Great. Well, we love that. We love our audience, and it's good to hear that they're out there and connecting with our guests as well. So really good stuff. Now, of course, Bill, our focus today is Greece, the very bizarre and interesting, if we can call it that, problem, if you will, that has been raving in Greece now for years, actually. It's been going for a long time. Tell us first how you got involved in this. Obviously, you have a background in economics. People who, you know, listened to our previous interview, they know all this stuff. But tell us how you got involved in starting to looking at Greece and helping Greece.
Well, I think it was last November I got invited to give the keynote address at an economics conference in Athens, put on by the Athens University of Athens University of Business, I think. And so they had organized it very hurriedly because, you know, they see the cliff coming in Greece. And I think the cliff can't happen until after the German elections, which I believe are in September. But in any case, I went and met a lot of very interesting people there. And basically a substantial portion of the business school understands exactly what the problem is and what should be done. But the major media and the whole political cadre is basically in the pocket of the European Union. And so it's very difficult. If all the Greek people started moving in the same direction as far as a solution goes, they could get this thing done. And sure, there'd be another year or so of hardship, but then they'd be out of it. And I mean, as it is now, connecting up to the euro is just going to further indebt the Greek people and indebt them in perpetuity. So yeah, you know, you can say, well, we can't fix this overnight, and you can't fix it overnight, but you can certainly fix it in a relatively short period of time and make Greece a free and sovereign nation once again, and able to fend for itself among nations.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, we hope that not only Greece but other countries as well in the European Union can manage to get themselves out of it in some way. It seems very unlikely, however. But if we talk about how the problem arose in Greece specifically, then tell us when it began, as you see it, and why they ended up in the situation they did.
Well, actually, let's back up one step, and that's you said it was unlikely, and I don't think it's unlikely at all. I think it's extremely likely that the EU will fall apart. In fact, you know, as you may know, I've been working a lot with in Iceland, and Iceland finally came out just last month. Their president made an announcement, and I guess it was their representative to the EU, announcing that they would no longer go after EU membership, which was a giant piece of news in the EU battle. That's the first nation that's actually started down the path and said, no, I don't think so. And so Iceland is just the first crack in a dam that will eventually burst. So it's not a question of if Greece gets out of the European Union. It's just a question of when. If Greece gets out on their own, then of course the pain will be less. But if they wait until they're actually booted out, which is also a possibility at some point, you know, then the pain's going to be maximal.
Yeah.
So, in any case, I forget the initial question.
Sure. No, I'll ask that again, but I wanted to just, you know, kind of continue on that and follow up on that. It's an interesting analysis and an interesting take on it that you have. And I mean, I hope you're right. I hope that that countries indeed will be able to, you know, get out. Hopefully then, as you say, it's not going to be because the situation is so dire and that they're being booted out. But nonetheless, what I've seen, Bill, is that I've seen that the weakening of nations, if you will, as they go into the EU, is one that has strengthened the centralized governmental structure of Europe, as opposed to, you know, is instead getting the countries individually to say, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with this. Let's get out while we can. It seems to be the reverse, that the worse it gets, the stronger the power gets. But in Greece, you said that's wrong then. But basically, they're standing right there at the cliff right now. Either they have to get out themselves or they will be booted out.
Well, it's because the GDP to debt situation is so bad in Greece that right now, and one of the big deals in German politics is the finance minister happened to accidentally let it slip that Greece was going to need another bailout, which I'm sure Angela Merkel was not pleased with her finance minister, because that's the one thing they haven't wanted to let out as the Germans go in to their elections, because the antagonism against the southern tier of EU nations, which basically is on life support from the industriousness of the German worker,
yeah,
it is growing quite quickly, and they're just trying to get through this election in September before then they really have to, the German government has to face the music about, okay, now what do we have to do now to hold this experiment together? So, yeah, there's their big selling point is that they are the rock. They are the tent under which these smaller nations can come, and Big Daddy Euro is going to protect them with loans, etc. But those loans essentially come out of the hide of the German people. But, you know, they're in a bad position because they have to have all these additional nations, just like in the United States, the Fed has to have additional borrowers to support the system, or else it'll collapse. So they absolutely have to have other nations coming into this to sustain the Ponzi scheme aspect of it. And yet the southern tier are already, there are major movements in all those nations, anti-EU movements, that will do nothing but grow. I mean, they're not going to diminish. They're going to grow from here on. And for example, there's even one in Latvia. Latvia has the strongest currency, in Europe as far as what, goes for against the dollar, and yet the Latvian government, against the wishes of the majority of the people, decided to go into the euro and abandon their sovereign money, the lat, as of the first of this coming year. And you know, that's a hot debate going on in Latvia right now, and nobody knows exactly how it's going to come out, but it's interesting. Hungary, for example, there's recent news from Hungary, and that is that they abandoned they went back to their sovereign currency maybe 3-4 years ago, and it's been a little shaky, but not so shaky as to last week paid off their final installment on their debt to the IMF, and then told the IMF to leave the country. So, you know, things are not as rosy as the pro-European Union folks would like to make it out.
Oh, sure.
The next elections in the United Kingdom, for example, are going to see the UKIP party, which is probably the strongest anti-EU party in Europe. They're going to make tremendous gains. So, the EU experiment, as far as I'm concerned, the corner has been turned and it's now doomed to failure. Mm. It might take years and years and years, but once the first country goes, you're going to see others follow.
Yeah, it's an interesting analysis. I mean, speaking about Germany, I know, and again, we're not going to forget about Greece here. We're going to return to that and discuss what happened to Greece, etc. But some people have claimed that, you know, this has been basically Germany's secret way to take control of the EU, to gain, you know, more and more influence over the Union and basically begin to dictate it. And although that, you know, on the surface might seem to be true, it's also true just as what you said, you know, Bill, that they are also the ones who have been, you know, being there as the backers, if you will, being there with real tangible industrial work being done. And therefore, should not their influence be fairly strong, considering how much they're, you know, are liable in terms of finances and everything else? How do you view this? Is it a German conspiracy, or is it, you know, right in the sense that they should have more influence and control because of all the money that they have at stake here?
Well, I've spent a lot of time in Germany in the past year, and I have an entirely different take on this. I think this is merely holdover German guilt from the Nazi regime, I think Merkel and company sincerely believe that if they can just bring all these nations under a big EU tent, that they can put an end to war, and that Germany still kind of deserves to be paying for all these nations, kind of as extended war reparations. It's the guilt in Germany still is very heavy for World War II.
Yeah. That's very unfortunate, and so who is taking advantage of that, or is it just are Germany driving this themselves?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a banker-led experiment in over consolidation of power, in an attempt to the thing these Bilderberger groups, the people who inhabit the Bilderberger meeting, the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., that they are trying to consolidate power. Now, they use the excuse that nationalism is the greatest evil in the world because it's what causes nations to go to war, and war costs money and kills people and devastates nice communities. But, you know, my belief is that when the founding fathers of the United States put together the Constitution, the basis of the U.S. Constitution is a very interesting concept that is nowhere mentioned in the actual document. And that's the separation of powers concept. And that's the U.S. government was set up with significant separated power blocks, so that if one group of people decided to turn towards despotism and started over-consolidating power, the other guys would still have enough power to gang up on them and, you know, put them down. And so what's the separation of powers concept on the international level? What is the concept that keeps the world relatively free from despotism, international, worldwide despotism? And of course, it's clear that it's the independent nation state. Because as Lord Acton of Great Britain in the 1800s put it, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And so you want the independent nation state as the bulwark of human freedom. For example, during World War II, what would have happened if we had a world government then and Hitler took it over? Well, we'd all be speaking German now as a first language. You know, it was only through the independent action of nation states that we were able to gang up and go put Hitler in his place. So I'm absolutely all for national sovereignty, for American national sovereignty, British national sovereignty, Chinese national, Russian national sovereignty. I don't care. I like nation states, and I like them grinding and competing against one another, and I think that's the only thing that keeps the world relatively free. And this attempt by the European Union, I think, if it succeeds, can lead to nothing but an ironclad world dictatorship ultimately.
Well, you're right. Who will run the world government, and what if it ends up in the wrong hands, Bill? That's the biggest question of all. And the question is, maybe it's already in the wrong hands. The inception of world government that we do have, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely, it's in the wrong hands. I mean, by definition, the larger the power blocks, the more difficult it is for the average person to access their government, to control their government. And, you know, in the United States, for example, it's a bunch of states. And the federal government in the Constitution is only granted power in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which is only 450 words long. And all the rest of all other powers that aren't granted specifically to the Congress of the United States are reserved for the states and for the people. So that really spreads out power significantly. Well, however, if you go to the average person in the United Kingdom right now, you ask them if they feel they can control their governance, they'll say no. And they say no because 85% of the laws of the legislation affecting the United Kingdom are made in Brussels right now. So yeah. Once power is consolidated, the people lose touch with it. And once they lose touch, then there's absolutely nothing that can occur but an ironclad world dictatorship, because the only way you keep your nation free is to keep people involved, keep them feeling that they actually are in control.
Do you really think, Bill, that the excuse, the official excuse, because, again, we always hear, you know, the League of Nations was set up after, the Second World War, later formed into the UN, etc., that this is... all of this is just because we'll try to prevent war, basically, and that's the official standing, explanation for why they need to have centralized government, etc. But obviously there is more behind the surface than that, and this has to do with control, as you said, consolidation of power to be able to manage basically the global population in a completely different way, because politicians are no longer, nationals in that sense. They're internationals, and they belong, they have their own self-interest at the heart of this matter. And that's what's driving this, as I see it anyway. What do you think, Bill?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's this over-consolidation of power can lead to only one thing, and that's an ironclad world dictatorship. And the truth of the matter is that nobody's just going to give you freedom. You can't just win freedom.
No.
Politically. You can win it temporarily, but the only way for it to be sustainable is you have to teach your children and your grandchildren, and you have to teach them to teach their children and grandchildren that they have to get in there and keep their hands dirty. Because if you do nothing, if once your population gets to the point where it's disenchanted with government, to where it won't get involved and actually give up something in order to stay in the mix, to keep fighting to keep their government in their hands, then it's absolute for sure that the bad guys will take your freedom away from you. You can't just, no one's going to give you freedom. You have to continually take it and retake it with every generation.
Yeah, and hold it and preserve it in that way, exactly. And it seems to be a constant throughout history that if you do nothing to kind of hold back, or at least take that personal responsibility of trying to, assess the situation and make sure that, you're on good ground, so to speak. Someone else will try to get in there, whether it's a mob or a government working in the same kind of fashion here. They will try to take advantage of the situation and get in there and take over the power, take the money, etc.
Well, once a nation gains its freedom and starts getting prosperous, the natural course of events is that the population takes their freedom for granted. They get fat and happy and lazy, and so therefore the nation is eventually crushed. And there's a theory that this is about a 200-year cycle, and that's probably true. But what we have to learn from history is that nobody's going, you can't just win your freedom in perpetuity. You have to keep re-winning it all the time. You have to keep that fresh. You have to understand what there are a group of guys and in this world who hate the fact that humankind has trudged down this path for the last 1,000 years of governments of self-determination as a way to escape serfdom. They hate that. They want to return the entire world to a state of serfdom. It's just their natural state. And that's what we're going to fight against for the rest of our lives and for the till the end of time. And until we learn as a group of free people what the source of our freedom is, and that's keeping hold, forming a government, all us little people throwing our little bits of power together, that's the only way we can possibly have any success against those people that I called the money masters in my first film.
An excellent film it is, by the way, as well, that shows this the infrastructure of the money system of what we're talking about right now. But do you think then, Bill, that it's only with violent force that this can be kept, or can it be done with politics? Can it be done with economics, with a free marketplace, etc.? Are there other means and modalities that you can do this on?
Well, if it goes too far, then the only way to do it is through violence. And, you know, I refuse to accept that. I refuse to accept that we're going to have to go that far, because we can still, especially with our ability to communicate independently of the previous nodes of media power, for example. That's what your station is all about. That's what this program is all about. You're completely circumventing the traditional modes of news, and yep. It's very, very effective. And I just read a story today about how young people in Athens are completely circumventing the internet. You know, which they're throttled down to, let's say, 5 megs download and 1 meg upload, but they figured out a way through putting up Wi-Fi antennas on their roofs so they can transfer Wi-Fi signals between themselves and completely go around the normal cable provider. And that's the way it is. That's what happens when people yearn for freedom. That's just on the small scale. On the political scale, that's the case too. But I mean, you see here in the United States, for example, I think the United States Congress has an approval rating of somewhere between 10 and 15% right now. And the bad guys love that. That they don't want you to be involved with your self-governance, because self-governance is the key. It's all we've got to hold back the forces of evil, essentially.
Very good. Yeah, necessity is the mother of all invention, as I say. And maybe we can come back to this and tie this in as well. But let's not forget about Greece here, Bill. Let's go back there, and maybe you can explain to people who haven't followed the Greek tragedy, if we can call it that, and what happened in the country, you know, when it began, and basically what we've seen is an ongoing austerity tragedy. So where would you place the initial point on all of this?
Oh, well, when you talk to the Greeks, they take it all the way back to Solomon in 500 BC.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
The Greeks are very proud of their history. They have a very ancient and wonderful history. And in fact, I've been told that the notion of odious debt, which is debt improperly put on a nation, originated in Greece. And so this is a recognized term in international law at this point, that when a group of politicians in a nation indebts the nation in an unjust way for their own enrichment or whatever, in a way that they shouldn't have done, then subsequent governments that come in can declare the debt that those people incurred as odious debt and therefore non-repayable. And of course, this is certainly the situation that that Greece is in at this point. The Greek central bank, for example, is just a joke. They call it the Bank of Greece, but you know, it's listed on the Athens Stock Exchange, for God's sake. They don't even try to hide the fact that it's a profit-making corporation. It does not operate in the benefit of the public interest. It operates, as every corporation does, for the benefit of the corporation. And you cannot have these privately owned central banks around the world pretending to operate in the public interest. You can't have them in control of the national money, because for sure they're mandated to manipulate the quantity of national money for their own benefit. And that means just the opposite of providing stability. It minimizes stability. Because the booms and busts, the ups and downs, do not benefit the middle class. They're the ones that suffer. That only benefits the banking class. And that's why you see it endemic throughout world history, is because typically they know that the keys to the kingdom are to get control over the quantity of money. Doesn't matter to them whether it's backed by gold money or whether it's completely fiat money. Does not matter one twit. All that matters to them is who is in control of issuing the quantity of money. Because when they can make money plenty and have a big bubble, and then withdraw the money, as is about to happen, and cause a deflationary depression, you know, everyone suffers in the country except for them, except for the banking class, because they know how to get out ahead of the curve and profit from either side of the picture. So, you know, it is the most solemn power, the greatest power of a sovereign nation is the money power. The ability to control the quantity of money in your country has to be done by the most democratic way possible. You just can't have nine guys working for a private corporation deciding behind closed doors how much money there's going to be in the country. I mean, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's an amazing situation, and what has happened again in Greece, that everything that's consequently unfolded is that it's been masked and everything else. I mean, there's a couple of news stories. One, we can go back to 2010, this is from Der Spiegel, I think, in Germany, when he mentioned that Goldman Sachs helped the Greek government to mask the true extent of its deficit with the help of derivatives. Deal that legally circumvented the EU Maastricht deficit rules. At some point, the so-called cross-currency swaps will mature and swell the country's already bloated deficits. And later on, now in 2013, just a couple of months ago here, was also revealed, this is from June actually, that Greece bank rescue funds had hired Rothschild and Goldman Sachs as advisors on the sale of lenders called the Proton and Hellenistic Post Bank, which are most likely to be bought by bigger Greek banks, you know, officials told Reuters on Friday. So what has been going on behind the scenes? Because just as you say here in detail, these are private, you know, banks coming in here and basically wheeling and dealing and telling the country what to do. And for some reason, the Greek, you know, banks as well are agreeing to this, and the politicians. Why? How did this happen?
Well, the politicians are agreeing to it because they're bought by the banks. I mean, these post banks around the world typically serve the public interest. And, of course, they try to take them down and privatize them, or, you know, whatever word they want to use. They want to get rid of them and pull them under the commercial banking establishment so that the commercial banks have an iron fist, ironclad control over the quantity of money in the country. Then they can create these booms and busts and benefit from it on both sides going up and both going down. And as far as the politicians go, you know, I started to get, you know, you can theorize that, oh, well, the banks buy the politicians, but you can't really get much hard data on that until I went to Israel. And after my first talk, a guy came up to me in Tel Aviv, and he goes, I want to set up a lunch date with you because I've got some important stuff to tell you. So I set it up. He was an attorney. He was the former, and it's in one of my still reports up on YouTube. He was a nephew of a former prime minister, and he was the head of a law firm that served the banking interests in the Knesset. And he had turned against the banking interests because he was sickened by how they were doing things. And that is, they in debt. It's not just that they give personal loans to the politicians. That's a little too transparent. But what they do is they indebt the political parties. There are, I think, eight major political parties in Israel, and the banks indebt them through something called short-term call loans. These are 30, 60, and 90-day notes that can be called, you know, for no reason at all, for any reason at all. They indebt them between 3 and 5 times the net worth of the entire party. And so on, you know, just with a month or two's notice, they can basically bankrupt any of the major parties in Israel. And that's, as my lawyer friend said, that's not significant control. That's absolute control. And he was there. Huh. He saw it happen. He knows how they do it. And so then when I went to Ireland, I found out, you know, that it's basically the same thing there, just it was in slightly different ways. For example, I went to, I did a speech in Northern Ireland in Belfast, and a member of the Green Party was there. And he said that they had just passed the most draconian, obnoxious law he can possibly imagine as far as governing politics. And that is, instead of being more transparent, they actually passed this, a law making it so that no one can ever know who the campaign contributors were to a legislative candidate in perpetuity. In other words, you can never know who contributed to what guy's campaign. That's right. Actually just been passed.
But the loans that you talked about in terms of Israel, the party still doesn't have to accept them, though, correct? They voluntarily go into this modality in the system, correct?
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's a competitive aspect about this. If Party A is just given a $10 million loan to advertise their party in upcoming elections, and then the bank approaches Party B and says, you know, Party A just got $10 million dropped on them to, you know, pay for TV advertising for the election, you know, that's going to put you in a pretty bad spot. But you know what? We'll give you the same deal. Now, what do you think Party B is going to do?
Well, they should go to the media and say, Party A is taking money from these banks.
Yeah,
no, but I know what you're saying. Yeah.
It should go to the media.
Yeah.
But you know what? The media, the major media, has now been compromised by the same process.
Sure.
When I was when I produced The Secret of Oz, I sent it to one of my friends who was president of one of the three major television networks here in the United States. And he hadn't contacted me much, but, you know, I'd talked to him in the past. And he got the film, and then he called back and said, this is great. And I was surprised. I said, well, you've never contacted me before about anything I've done. Why do you think this is good? And he said, because we hate those bastards at J.P. Morgan. And he explained the way Morgan, and it's just Morgan, for some reason, Morgan is the one that controls the media in New York. They do it through loans. They have the all the networks mortgaged out to the max. They'll go to the network and say, you know, we'd like to finance a brand new studio for you so that you can look better than your opposition. And the guys will say, okay, yeah, we'll do that. And then, you know, then they'll go across the street to the other network and say, you know, network A, they just got a big loan for a brand new studio. You know, you're going to be left out in the cold. And so they get a loan too. And, you know, so pretty soon they're mortgaged out to the max to where the network, my friend said, could not even pay the interest on the notes. They had to have the notes every 12 months completely rolled over. And once again, that gives Morgan complete power. It's not that, you know, they're there in the studio making all news decisions, but the producers just know, you know, let's just not talk about certain things.
Yeah. So do you think that there are certain things maybe written into the contracts for the loans or anything like that? Or maybe nothing is on paper. This is more kind of nudge-nudge kind of stuff maybe.
Nothing would be on paper. You know, it would just be a case of if the network did the wrong thing, maybe the bank – this is the way it was explained in Israel. The banker would just call up and say, you know, we're a little short this month. We're just going to have to call your loans.
Yeah, exactly.
Wouldn't give them any excuse.
Well, I mean, what it shows too, though, it shows that there's no interest, obviously, from the people behind those institutions of the media to preserve any kind of, well, dignity in that sense. But even, you know, they turn it into a money-making process, of course, and there's so much, you know, involved in that process. But, you know, fortunately, we do have alternative media. We have all these other, you know, things that are on the rise and actually can, you know, give out a different message in this. If we look at Greece again, how has that been in your view? Because, I mean, I'm not in contact with too many Greek people, unfortunately, and you know, would love to have someone on who could you know, describe the situation there a little bit more in detail as well. You've been there, of course, but is there any good alternative media in Greece as you see it?
Well, yeah, there is. And there's a guy by the name of Georgios Tragas who runs the largest magazine in Greece. Who is one of the people who asked me to come to return back to Greece. After I finished my documentary, Jekyll Island, which we finished in June, come back and do a documentary on Greece, not only for the people in country, but because basically the country is so impoverished right now, there's not much they can do. But the Greek expatriate community around the world has almost as much population as the in-country population, and they're much more wealthy. And so what you want to do is try to mobilize them to provide money to political parties who are seeing this the right way. And so we've just got to get them all marching in the same direction and convince them that, you know, further indebting themselves to the European Union is not the solution to their problems, because the only choice you have there are, as you mentioned earlier, austerity, continued and ratcheting up austerity, or some sort of money printing scheme, which, of course, Greece doesn't even have any choice. They can't print euros on their own. So all they can do is borrow euros. And, you know, this is just a horrible, sorry to go back to Israel, but I know the economic numbers better in Israel. For example, in Israel, one third of the budget goes towards repaying government loans and national debt, both principal and interest. This is a huge number. And, you know, this is Israel, for God's sakes. In Greece, it's probably even greater. And yet the politicians snuck through a rechartering of the Bank of Greece last December, I believe, for 50 years. 50 years, and they wrote in the legislation that no subsequent legislation can change this. It's a 50-year charter, no holds barred. And yes, this is a charter to a private corporation calling itself the Bank of Greece, pretending to operate in the public interest. So, you know, the politicians for the most part are bought off, and there's so many different splinter parties in Greece, all with, you know, different solutions, that we've just got to get in there and make one solution, one simple solution that people can understand, and get everybody marching in basically the same direction.
Have some of these austerity measures been about destroying Greeks, the Greek history, if you will? I mean, considering they've been thriving on tourism, everything else. I don't know how tourism is there still at this stage. Do you know if that's still something that's going? But, you know, furthermore, there's so many, you know, ancient temples, landmarks, etc. there. But a lot of this was being basically sold out, like rented out or something like that. Do you know if this, any of this followed through, any of these suggestions?
You know, I don't know the specifics of that, whether they, because I think maybe there were suggestions of that, but I'm not sure that I just don't know the situation on that. The Greeks are awfully proud of that sort of stuff, but
sure.
I do know things like they're sucking up all of the natural resources, like all the silver production of the country has had to go as collateral to these EU loans. Greece has a lot of waterfront property on the Mediterranean, and so there's a lot of oil and natural gas exploration that can be done. Now, trillions of cubic feet of natural gas, and the EU is attempting to snag all that. And, you know, but the solution is pretty simple. Just a new government comes in and says, nope, all those previous agreements are null and void. They're odious debt, and we're killing them off right here. And, you know, withdraw from the euro, reestablish the drachma. Of course, the drachma would float on the international market. That would devalue the drachma. But, you know, what's wrong with that? All that would mean would be that Greeks would no longer be able to afford to import BMWs from Germany or plastic toys off of ships from China. And so what's wrong with that? That would immediately stimulate investors worldwide to start up internal manufacturing once again in Greece, which now has almost completely broken down.
Yeah.
Every nation needs to make most of the basic stuff that they use internally. It's not hard. Almost every nation can do it. The little bit that you have to trade from one nation to another, that's not a big problem. But the way it is now, where everything is imported off of ships, is just completely unsustainable and centralizes the manufacturing power in just a few nations, you know, which basically thrive on slave labor. And, you know, that's not freedom. That's not a democratic response. That's not humanity marching forward.
No, of course not. You're right. You mentioned a year of hardship earlier, that they might have to, you know, to go kind of go through that to be able to take themselves, you know, back up on their feet again. Is this what you're talking about then? Basically, they would have to take a hard hit to try to exit out of the EU and start things up on their own, basically set up an industry again and start producing what they would need, you know, internally in the country, and then eventually maybe you could begin to, you know, trade, I guess, with the outside world again. Or how do you see this year of hardship? What is that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's just getting manufacturing going once again. But, you know, Greece isn't going to starve. The world is not going to let Greece starve. The United States is a generous country. And the other European nations, it's a cradle of civilization. I mean, Greece is not going to starve. And it'll take probably about a year to start to see significant results. But, you know, look what's going to happen in the next year if they don't. You're going to see even further demands for Greek borrowing, further demands on austerity measures. And Greece is starving to death as it is now. I mean, you don't have to Google around on the internet very much to see horror stories of suffering on the streets of Greece. So it's a bad situation, and we're going to try to fix it.
Well, exactly. I mean, let's talk about, you know, some of your projects you have running here right now as well. You mentioned, you know, as soon as you'd finished Jekyll Island, you're going to focus on another documentary, correct, on the Greek situation and everything else. You had a couple of fundraisers kicked off as well. Just tell us what you've been doing lately and what your plan is next here, Bill.
Yeah, well, I'm speaking in Turkey I'm giving a keynote address at an international economics conference. I don't know why they want a filmmaker when it's filled with bigwig politicians. But they want me to kick off the second day, so I assume what they want me to talk about, and they haven't really said that they're letting me decide. But of course, it's an opportunity for me to give the same song and dance basically that I just gave you. That, you know, the EU is going to collapse at some point. It's the Titanic getting ready to sink, and the Turkish government, previous Turkish governments have done everything they can to get into the EU. They have a new government right now. And basically, the invitation that I got was from the office of the president of Turkey. And so I imagine that's what they want. They want me to come in and give the anti-EU view before they jump over the cliff and onto the sinking Titanic. So thereafter, I'm going to come back and go through Athens. We're going to scout the filming sites just so I can figure out what's involved and how long it's going to take, and finish up the script as much as we can, because of course when you interview a lot of people, the script changes, and then come back and mount up my equipment and go on back to Athens and do the project. We're starting another Indiegogo project for the a much larger project for all of the funding of the film, so that'll be up in a day or two, and we're gonna try to make something work.
Yeah, definitely. You have to send me the link as well once that is up. So, what do you hope to see come out of this work and this project? Do you think that things can be turned around? How viable is something like this?
Well, it's easily viable. I mean, you see, even within the various different parties in Greece, you see, you know, a few politicians here and there saying, yeah, we've got to change this. You know, austerity's killing us. The EU is not the answer. And, you know, we need to give those people some political tool that can help them gain recognition and gain adherence and try to get the politicians back on track. I mean, politicians are changeable, and you can make them change their minds if enough people say, look, I mean, either do what we want or we're going to kick you out of office. You know, politicians will suddenly have a change of heart. You know, but what we need is we really need to get everybody going in the same direction on what the root of the problem is and how to fix it. And the root of the problem is debt. And there's only one way to fix debt, and that's not with more debt. You have to get out of this debt mentality. You have to pay as you go in Greece. And what you can't pay for, then you just have to cut government services. And, you know, I know that's going to be a huge social change for people in Greece, but it's just absolutely necessary. You can't spend beyond your means, especially nations. It's so easy and so tempting for a group of politicians, instead of raising taxes or cutting government services, to say, oh, well, just issue some bonds, increase the national debt. And, you know, then all of my constituents can have everything that they're asking for, and their grandchildren will have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Everybody just kind of forgets about it. But that's exactly what's going on. And, you know, this indebtedness gives who do you think nations borrow the biggest amount of money from? They borrow it from the people with the most money. And who's that? Bankers.
Right, yeah.
So if you have a legislature borrowing money for its nation from bankers, how do you think you're ever going to get a piece of legislation through that's going to control the bankers? It's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said that the very first thing that we've got to do to fix all these problems in nation states economies is you have to get in the public consciousness, no more national debt. Just stop it. None. Zero. No matter what happens, no more borrowing.
Well, it's a very good point you bring up there. I mean, politicians get up there, they promise fixes, you know, more money for you guys, you know, we're going to fix it all. It's short-term thinking. And of course, you know, for people who don't understand what's going on or how it's functioning, they think, yeah, you know, why should I take a hit or suffer, you know, in that sense for something that's maybe someone did many, many years ago. Maybe it's, the situation is worse than that. It's we're talking hundreds of years ago, but nonetheless, the idea there is that, as you say, people... Many people don't want that situation. They rather think on the short term and say, okay, well, I'll, you know, if they can even comprehend and understand the full context of what they're saying yes to, but they accept the politicians to basically give them the short term fix. But in the long term, this is what's going to destroy the whole thing. And it seems kind of inevitable that this cycle will just kind of continue, Bill, unless I guess people are informed about what their choices is going to bring, you know?
Exactly. Informed is the word. And the problem is that the banking community has learned how to co-opt the three major sources of truth in a nation. Those three sources are, number one, the politicians. That's why we elect them, to go and fix the problems and tell us the truth. Of course, we now know how that has been co-opted. Then it's the media, and now I gave you the example of how that's been co-opted, once again, through debts, through loans. And the third major pathway to truth that most people don't really think about, but it's very influential, is the academic community. And if the academics don't rise up against a media that's not telling the truth, then, you know, that's really the backstop to the media community. Because any professor of note could stand up at any point on a major media outlet and say, you guys just aren't telling the story. And, you know, that would be a significant threat. So, for example, I don't know how this is done in other countries, but from seeing how these other two branches of truth have been assailed, I assume that it must be the same elsewhere. And that is the Federal Reserve System in about the 1970s started a program of visiting professorships, various academic, I don't know, I forget the name. Anyway, there are a variety of titles that the Fed gives these guys where they'll bring a professor into one of the Federal Reserve banks for a year, and they'll give them a lot of money to perform economic studies. And, you know, so consequently, it turns out, that, for example, in many of there are only seven major economics journals here in the United States, and in some of the journals, the editorial board of the journal are filled with people who have either worked for the Fed or plan on working for the Fed. And so, according to a New Yorker article of just a few months ago, the Fed completely dominates the editorial boards of the major economics journals. And so no anti-Fed study paper will ever get into these. So between that and the fact that last time figures were available, which was 2010, do you know how much the Fed spent just on paying for studies to the 15, there are only 1,500 monetary economists working in the United States, and yet the Fed spread around between them $450 million a year. Now, if you're a professor and you're getting, you know, on average a couple hundred grand from the Fed, you know, that's more than doubling your salary. So are you, you're going to pretty much turn the other way.
Yeah, you're not going to attack it and criticize it. Of course not.
Especially if, you know, it would threaten your job altogether. And what's a professor going to do if he can't work as a professor anymore? He's going to work at McDonald's? No, I don't think so.
Well, independent investigations, independent reports, independent people who are monitoring and looking, that is the way to go, you know. But we'll continue to talk about that and much more, Bill, in the second segment. I have so much more I want to ask you about, you know, going on from these things, both from Greece, EU, but also the bigger kind of picture here. Let's give out some websites here, though. Obviously, we talked about the Indiegogo pages. We're going to have those linked up as soon as they are up, the new ones there. But give us your websites, Bill, so people know where to go to kind of check out your documentaries and everything else that you have available.
Well, the main website is pretty easy. It's www.billstill.com, and pretty much everything is linked up from there. But there's a separate website for the new Jekyll Island movie because a production company actually funded that. And so to get that, which actually does talk about the Fed usurping these three major branches of truth, that's the first time I just figured all this out recently and put it in this latest documentary. In any case, that's jekyllisland-themovie.com. Then Jekyll is J-E-K-Y-L-L, island-themovie.com.
All right, very good. Billstill.com, the main website, and the other ones here we'll have up on redicecreations.com as well. Stay with us, Bill. Much more to come here. We'll return after a short break. We'll be right back. Thank you. All right, boys and girls, we'll proceed with Bill Steele in the next segment. Our second hour for our members is coming up at redicemembers.com. You can go there to acquire a subscription or read more about it. You can, of course, check out our archives. You don't have to be a member to see all the good stuff that we have there for you. But do sign up and tune in, because we have a lot of good stuff for you right there. We're going to continue to talk about how government, media, and the economic system is at the hands of a very few bankers. It's an imploding Ponzi scheme, and although there is a lot of bad news on the horizon for those who understand how the system works, there are also a lot of good developments that are encouraging and positive, and we'll speak about some of these signs on the horizon. And by the way, next up on Radio 314, we have Anna Maria and Brian Clement on Toxic Clothing, a very interesting program that you shouldn't miss, stuff you never knew about the clothes that you wear every day, and what kind of toxic chemicals the fabrics have been treated with that is the cause of all kinds of health problems. Then on Red Eyes Radio, we have Suzanne Venker on the War on Men, and later down the road, we have Joseph Atwill and Ryan Gilmore. Also have another big roundtable on the past and our future. After this, Charles Eisenstein and Anthony Peake, to name a few. But we'll continue right now then with Bill Steele, so we'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening.